This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's at least another week of debt talks coming to us. That's guaranteed. On a related note, getting politicians to play nice. And our China series, the five-year plan, American companies that get it and those that don't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. For more about the latest business and economic news from Marketplace, visit marketplace.org to discover even more of the news you love from Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 15th of July. Great to have you with us. And where to begin today? What was the big economic story of the week again? Anyone? All right, enough. We'll talk debt and all the rest in our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Here to do 4 minutes of live radio this week are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so we'll get to the debt thing in a minute, but first, Sudeep, let's talk about the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke. Goes to the Hill Wednesday and says, yes, absolutely, we can do more stimulus to get the economy going if we have to. Goes back on Thursday and says, no, wait, never mind, we really can't. Help us make up his mind here. What's he going to do?
It is pretty confusing, and the difference was the number of questions he got on one day versus the other on this particular issue. He's really in this careful dance right now, trying to improve the public's confidence without sounding terrified about this latest slowdown. He wants to show that the Fed isn't out of tools entirely if it were in a crisis. What I find amazing, though, is that people in markets actually think it'll make a big difference for the Fed to do more, and our problems today are just not about borrowing costs, which are really historically low. They're about much more fundamental issues around housing, around too much debt in households. And those are the things that the Fed can't really solve right now.
Yeah, and the jobs and the economy. Lee, let me ask you this, though. The markets followed Bernanke up on Wednesday, down on Thursday. They don't, though, seem to be following the debt fiasco, right? Why aren't bond yields going crazy? Why aren't stocks tanking? Why isn't everything in the markets going haywire?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think the Fed has a singular ability to move markets more than almost anybody else. I think, you know, much of the talk in Washington is so political, and I think the markets realize that. And I think there is an expectation that we're not going to default, that this is all just show and theater. And Bernanke's kind of a different story. And the other thing with Bernanke is that, I mean, people love to parse his words. The markets love to just take what he says. And he really should know better. He's been in the job for 5 years now. He should know that his words are going to pull the, you know, if he says, we all options have to be on the table. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. So
talking for a second, though, about this idea that we aren't going to default, that we're going to get a deal. I mean, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, said a couple of things the last 2 days that I think are interesting. One was yesterday he said, you know what, we're going to have some procedural votes next week. We're not talking about a debt limit vote until Thursday, Friday. So we got to deal with a whole nother 5 days of these things, Sudeep. And he also said, listen, if we get a deal, it's a crapshoot. We don't know if we're going to get one or not. I mean, the man's a Speaker of the House.
He is the Speaker of the House, and he's trying to deal with a House base that is really all over the place right now. And the leadership in the Senate and in the White House has really acknowledged that this is too much of a risk to not come up with a deal. So they have some proposals floating around that should at least prevent that. The risk now is that we get a short-term solution on the debt ceiling without actually addressing the longer-term deficit problem. And that means this will drag on even longer, perhaps before we get to another election.
Well, Lee, how long? I mean, are we literally talking like at some point on the 2nd of August, they're going to say, poof, we got a deal?
Well, I think it's looking more increasingly likely that this sort of Plan B, which is you know this which has just emerged in the past couple of days, the way to effectively pass raising the debt ceiling without having any Republican fingerprints on it, which
right.
of this course
is
all
the,
that this is about.
Yeah, this is the McConnell plan. It lets the president raise it, and then Congress has to veto, and it gets very political very fast.
Exactly. But you know what? With that Plan B, at least it gets done. I mean, it's already political. And I think that's one of the things that's really kind of changing here. I think the manipulative tactics and the taking the economy at its most fragile place, probably in history, hostage and kind of holding it around like a lit neutron bomb until something's decided. I think that there's a limit on how long that can go on.
That's a horrible image, a lit neutron bomb. Sudeep, what do you think? 11th hour sometime on the 2nd of August, they say, yeah, we're done?
I think we are going to get some kind of a deal even before the 11th hour. But we've actually done a lot of damage already because there are so many people, investors and consumers, who are watching the circus with utter disbelief about how our country operates. And that's going to actually have some important implications for the economy. I've talked to two executives this week who said, yes, we have plenty of money to invest, but why do it here when we're in this much dysfunction?
Man.
And why not do it in China where the government says it'll do what it'll actually carry out what it says it'll do? And so that's a frightening prospect.
Interesting. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine in New York. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
What movement there was on Wall Street today was to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Do a quick economic riff on the Bard here for a minute. For all the attention we've been paying this week to the down-to-the-wire wrangling over the debt ceiling, might just end up being a whole lot of sound and fury signifying absolutely nothing. That's essentially the message from one of the big credit rating agencies. Standard & Poor's says just raising the debt limit's not going to do it. It's still 50-50, S&P says, that they're going to downgrade Uncle Sam from its hard-earned AAA unless politicians can come to terms on a credible deficit reduction plan. Which does kind of make one wonder what credible means. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Lawmakers are already well aware that just raising the debt ceiling isn't enough. During Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's appearance before senators yesterday, New York Democrat Charles Schumer voiced his worry about kicking the tough decisions down the road.
Do you agree that eventually the markets would start to get nervous that we can't find the political will to get a meaningful deal together and might start to view us a little more like Europe?
It's important both to raise the debt ceiling to avoid these kinds of problems we discussed. It's also important to show that we can make progress on the long-term deficit.
But if the debt ceiling is raised, why should politics affect the country's credit rating? Nicholas Swan is a sovereign credit analyst at Standard & Poor's. He suggests the U.S. is going down a road that's gotten other nations into trouble.
Many of the defaults that have happened on sovereign government debt have been primarily driven by the politics of the country.
Swan says the S&P credit watchers won't be satisfied until policymakers agree to a credible plan with bipartisan support, and he even has a specific number in mind.
Mathematically, to get there, it seems to us that you would need a package of at least in the neighborhood of $4 trillion over 10 years.
If it sounds like S&P is dictating policy, Swan says no.
We do not advise any borrower on which we have a credit rating. They are free to do what they wish to. But we will analyze the decisions that they make.
At the Peterson Institute for International Economics, policy expert Ted Truman says the agencies aren't saying anything the politicians don't already know. Their foot-dragging could end up pushing the cost of credit higher.
It's not the action of the credit rating agency that causes the interest rates to go up. It's the inaction by the political authorities. Don't shoot the messenger.
Although in this case, the messenger does wield a lot of power, a credit downgrade could affect the cost of borrowing for all of us. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On our last day in Shanghai, before we came home, we had kind of an L.A. moment. Reminded me a lot of a game people play around the office sometimes. The one where, if they made a movie of this place, who would play you? So we were sitting in my hotel room doing an interview with expat American businessman Jim Rice. He first came to China 20 years ago, right after college.
I stayed mostly at the time. It was because I thought the women were beautiful and the beer was cheap. And so it turned into a career. Not the women or the beer, but the working in China.
Suffice it to say, he's a character, hail fellow, well-met, knows everybody, heads up the Shanghai chapter of the local Harley-Davidson Club, and now is an unofficial consultant on a Hollywood movie. It's about an American lawyer who comes to China on assignment, fumbles his way through the finer points of cultural interaction, and winds up looking for help from some old China hands.
One of the American business people he turns to is based on me, and this character is governor of the American Chamber of Commerce, like I am, and president of a chicken company, and rides a Harley. So.
And who plays you in the movie?
Bill Paxton.
Oh, look, it's Bill Paxton.
Hello.
And there it was, our Hollywood moment.
Just happened to be walking by your suite. And I heard my name and, you know, I'm an actor, so of course I showed up.
Hanging out with Bill Paxton in the Shanghai Marriott on Tomorrow Square. All right, so maybe we took a little bit of poetic license there, but there is a point. Because if Hollywood's finally figured out there's a movie to be made about American companies coming to China, there must be something to it. You know what? There is. American companies that came to China found their fortunes or lost their shirts. That's later in the show. And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials pushed up 42 points this Friday, a third of 1%, closed at 12,479. The NASDAQ struck up 27 points, nearly 1%, ended at 2789. The S&P 500 hiked up 6 points, a half percent, finished at 1315. For the week, though, yeah, not so good. The Dow off 1.4%, the NASDAQ down 2 4/10, the S&P 500 slid 2%. Clorox scrubbed up nearly 9% today on news that Carl Icahn is bidding to buy the company out. He already owns about 9% of it. Google added nearly 13% today after its earnings beat most analysts' forecasts. Much of the rest of the tech sector followed. Apple up 2%. Microsoft stepped up more than 1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.9% even. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day on the web at manta.com. By Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The Humane Society's Taking Action for Animals Conference wraps up with a lobby day on Capitol Hill. And Nobel Peace Prize winner Nelson Mandela turns 93. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Smack in the middle of the rancorous debate over the debt ceiling this week, there was another not-so-pleasant conversation going on in Washington. Elizabeth Warren took another turn in front of a House subcommittee to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She's the one who first proposed the CFPB. It made it into the Dodd-Frank reform bill from last year, and it's set to open up shop next week, even though nobody's been nominated to run the place, hence the hearing. The panel was pretty testy with Warren, and members were with each other as well, breaking down mostly along party lines. And then at one point, Representative Jim Cooper, Democrat from Tennessee, took the floor, and he said there's got to be a better way. Here's part of what he said.
Some of us come here, and we get so used to the food fight that we want it to continue. And you'll probably score brownie points. If you make your partisan hit, you might even get on a better committee. Well, congratulations. You will not have solved a problem.
He went on for 5 minutes along those lines. Congressman Cooper, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
There was quite a set of remarks, I guess congressmen call it, when they speak. What drove you to make those remarks yesterday?
Working in this Congress is deeply frustrating. In fact, it's enraging. My colleagues are misbehaving. They're posturing for voters back home. They're taking the cheap political hit instead of studying the problem that's before us. And our nation has tons of problems. And they require a lot of work to diagnose them and then prescribe the right treatment.
Anybody come up to you yesterday after the hearing the other day and say, hey, Jim, I'm with you. I got your back on this one. Let's fix this.
I got tons of compliments. In fact, no criticism. And it made me wonder why the folks who were complimenting me weren't going ahead and behaving better already.
You know, there is a lot on the line here, though, right? I mean, there's the literally the credibility of the nation, the credit of the nation. There is, in the specific case of Ms. Warren, regulating the finances and the flow of capital in this country. Where do we go if on the biggest issues, the most important issues to our economy, we can't work and play well with others?
We have to be able to talk to each other and to disagree without being disagreeable. Now there's so much cynicism. There's so much negativity. People are almost hoping for a scandal or an outrage. And today, the media spin is so tough and there's so little real news. It's more info entertainment that we have to take a deep breath, count to 10, try to get to the real issues, and then solve them in an amicable fashion.
How did this happen, though? I mean, you said at one point the other day, you know, it didn't used to be like this when you got to Congress, you know, 10 years ago. What happened?
Well, there are a lot of factors. I've noticed that my colleagues misbehave more when there are cameras in the room. I also know that many people in Washington barely know each other anymore because Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker, basically banned people living in Washington. So oftentimes we barely know each other's names, and that makes it easier to fight. But the bottom line is this. It's a fundamental lack of patriotism. People are not putting the country first, and they're putting their own careers first.
You know, Congressman, you are a member of the Blue Dog Democrats, the fiscally conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Is there not some legitimacy on the part of the Republicans when they say, listen, we got to control things around here?
Absolutely. And I'm a Democrat who actually welcomes the Tea Party movement because they've refocused us on the debt issues that we'd ignored for too long. But it's not enough to complain about it. You have to actually get in there and solve the problem. And lots of my colleagues don't want to look at, for example, the Bowles-Simpson Deficit Reduction Commission recommendations. Those have been out there since last December. How many people have studied that 65 pages and know what they'll vote for or disapprove of? Very few people are thinking in more than a soundbite today.
Do you have any hope that our present circumstance with the debt and our budget and the economic problems this country still faces, that we will have a change in politics?
Our chief ally in World War II, Winston Churchill, said that America can always be counted on to do the right thing after it's exhausted all the alternatives. So if we put things in perspective, we can realize that, hey, we've bounced back from a lot tougher circumstances than this. We can and will, and we must do it again.
Congressman Jim Cooper, Democrat of Tennessee. We've got his remarks from the Elizabeth Warren hearing the other day on our website. It's marketplace.org. Give him a listen. Congressman, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Appreciate it.
Our series this week, The 5-Year Plan, takes us to China and the live broadcasts we did from there in 2006. We went back last month to see what's changed for them and for us.
The real estate bubble is going to bust.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
All right, so here's something that wasn't in China when we were here 5 years ago. Harley Davidson. Our first Saturday in Shanghai, we went out to the local Harley dealer to take a ride with the Hogs, the Harley owners group, both Chinese and Americans.
Hi, I'm Jim Rice.
Our guide is Jim Rice. You met him earlier. He's one of those people Malcolm Gladwell would call a connector. Knows everybody, schmoozes everybody, makes introductions. The Chinese call it guanxi. Essentially, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
I think we're going to get rained out.
Yeah, this is actual rain, too.
Sadly, we've come to China at the start of rainy season, and Shanghai traffic is lethal enough without riding a motorcycle on wet, slippery streets. So we don't go. Instead, it's coffee and donuts upstairs in what I guess you'd call a clubhouse. Hey. Couches, coffee tables, Harley memorabilia everywhere. An average Harley Davidson back home costs maybe $15,000, $16,000. Here, thanks to import duties, $35,000 or $40,000.
It's very luxurious. It's very, very expensive.
Jimmy Jung is one of today's rained-out riders.
People are out here now trying to show off their wealth. when you ride a bike, I think head turning around Shanghai with a Harley is maybe more than a Ferrari now.
He's also going to open a Harley dealership himself out in Suzhou, about 50 miles west of Shanghai, because he wants a piece of this growth industry. Just 6 months in, sales this year have already beaten all of 2010. It's an American brand that speaks to a changing Chinese sensibility. Sean Zhang is the managing director for Harley-Davidson China.
Even in such a traditional society as China, there are population. They are in a position financially, mentally, and socially to be able to use an American icon product to distinguish themselves and to show that they're successful.
Their customers are successful, so Harley's successful. Zhang plans to add 3 or maybe 4 new dealerships every year for the next 4 years. Harley knows it needs to be in China in part because of another American icon.
Everybody knows about GM's success here. They have done such a beautiful job in identifying a local partner, and their relationship with the local partner is very, very strong. And that's in the industry, it's a known story.
The story of GM is one of the highlights of corporate America in China. It's been hugely profitable here, even as it was being bailed out at home.
When I came here 6 years ago, we did just over 550,000 units. Last year, we did 2.35 million units.
Sales up 400%, so you could say it's been a good run for Kevin Whale. He took over GM China in 2005.
How do you square, then, the bailout that General Motors got from the federal government with the profitability that you guys have here? Make that make sense to the American taxpayer.
General Motors has been around for a long time. People were aware that we developed a whole series of legacy costs associated with various things. If you contrast that to China, we started with a clean slate. We moved into the market at the right time.
You can say that again.
We moved into the market at the right time.
That would be the time of an exploding Chinese middle class, complete with middle class aspirations like wanting to own a car. Timing, it turns out, really is everything.
So this is the cashier. That's the GMAC desk, though, so financing.
Richard Choi meets us at a dealership selling GM's latest China brand, Chevy.
This is our beginning to be our accessories area.
It's only been on the market here since 2005, but last year they sold 1 million cars, including quite a few, here at the biggest dealership in Shanghai. Richard Choi runs Chevy's China sales and marketing. He knows exactly what he's going after. Wannabe buyers, 25 to 35, probably with a family or soon to start one.
So we're trying to capture that in terms of how we are positioning Chevrolet. Our slogan, actually, is the future is coming for me. Wei lai wei wo er lai. The whole idea about this is to say Chevrolet is a brand. We understand that you're on your way, and we want to be the car that takes you there.
Before those customers can get on their way, they have to come see Ms. Wu. She's the sales manager, so I ask her to give me the sales pitch. It's a little bit like in the States and a little bit different.
Game on, they get sales talk.
We say hi, she says, as soon as they walk in. We give them our name card. And we ask them whether it's the first time they've been here. There's not a whole lot of negotiation, she says. The price is the price is the price. There's a sporty-looking red coupe over in the corner, but I try to be the sensible consumer and look for something that'll fit my family.
Okay, what's that mean? Well, you're sick of shower.
I've got 4 kids, I tell her. 6 people to schlep around. Not a commonly heard problem here in the land of the one-child policy. But Miss Wu doesn't miss a beat. Buy 2 cars, she says, and like all good salespeople, creates opportunity out of disadvantage. Kind of like GM in China. But when we told our Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, over dinner one night about our tale of American companies doing it right here, he offered us a slightly different take. And so we met up at Hong Kong Plaza in Shanghai, one of the 2 biggest shopping districts in the city. We were outside a very empty Gap store, a company that most definitely got it wrong with a high-profile branding campaign here, their 1969 jeans.
The Gap decided that one of its major lines of clothing, the 1969 jeans brand, it would be its cornerstone of its marketing here in China. 1969 might have been an interesting year in the U.S. It was not an interesting year in China. In fact, it was towards the end of the Cultural Revolution. It's a time in China when people were burning down monasteries, they were defacing Buddhist statues, they were torturing intellectuals. Not really a year that you want to remember.
That's cultural misfire number one. The 1969 campaign is what Gap's had in stores in the United States, of course, so that is misfire number two, not localizing your brand. But for all the successes and mistakes that American companies have made so far, now, says longtime businessman Ken Kettle, is the time to figure it out and get it right.
Last year sometime, I was having a conversation with a bunch of other guys that I know who've been here 15, 20 years. And one of the guys said, okay, would you rather have been here 20 years ago till now or now in 20 years from now?
Oh, good question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who said, no, now, because now is when it's real. Now, GM relies on China to be hitting on all cylinders or else something bad happens. That is cool. We were just playing. We were a garage band before. We were just a garage band. And you know what? If you go out and make a few bucks, cool. It's fun. But it's real now in a way that it never has been.
It's easy to forget how little time has passed since China wasn't much more than a global economic afterthought. It was 40 years ago today that President Nixon announced he was going to go to Beijing and meet with Chairman Mao. Since then, well, I mean, come on. Since then, just look at what's happened. It's enough to make the world's biggest economy a little uneasy, uncertain, really, about the unknown. That's why we went to China 5 years ago, and it's why we went back. As often happens when you travel, any place, cab drivers can deliver perspective along with a ride to wherever you're going. Wang Zhuqi has been driving a taxi in Chongqing for 15 years. China growing like it has is a good thing, he says. It'll make things better for other countries. And yeah, that's basically the party line here. But it's also not entirely wrong. Because as we said when we started this week, the global economy is going to need some help. And it ain't the developed world that's driving things these days. One last bit of China cabbie wisdom before we wind things up. We were, I don't even remember where we were, in a cab one day. And our Chinese producer asked the driver when we'd be there. And he said in Chinese, "Ma shang zhou dao le," pretty common phrase, but pretty vague too. It can mean like 5 minutes or it's going to be a little while. And it occurs to me that that's what we've been trying to get to all week. When's China going to be ready to help out? Could be soon. Could be a while.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And that's it. We're all done on this Friday. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow pushed up 42 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ struck up 27 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 hiked up 6 points, about a half percent. Our China series, the five-year plan, was produced by Deborah Clark. Fiona Ng didn't get to go along with us, but she did most of the heavy lifting back here. All that great sound you heard all week? Jeff Peters, our audio engineer, did that. Our web stuff was produced by Amir Nouri. And we put together a special audio feature from our China coverage this week. It's on our website. You can download it or listen to it online, marketplace.org. Look for the thing that says the five-year plan. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. This guy by the name of J.J. Yor. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, when caveat emptor doesn't work, that's when the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau kicks in.
She just didn't fully disclose all of the potential damages that could happen. You know, I really didn't fully understand what, I was getting into.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We will see you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.